Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Well, we have found ourselves facing some new things to be concerned about when it comes to protecting the country we love, and I mean that in a very literal sense. We've been discussing this problem that arose when a large container ship called the Dali crashed into one of the support pylons of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore Harbor with catastrophic effects. The bridge collapsed. The port has been closed for quite some period of time, presumably. There was a loss of life, unfortunately, as well, but the economy of the region and indeed the nation, the transportation sector, the commercial sector, the trade sector have all been impacted. And it is unlikely, in my estimation, that that will be the last time we find disruptions of our critical infrastructure, whether accidental, as may be the case in this instance, we don't know, may be purposeful. To talk about all of that, I'm very pleased to have with us one of our featured guests here at Securing America. His name is Bill Walton. He happens to have his own television program. And if you are a close student of it, as I hope you are, you will recognize that Bill is in his studio where he films the Bill Walton Show. I've been privileged to be a guest, not for a long time, I might say, but it's been my pleasure to be in that studio and always a pleasure to have him in ours, virtually at least. Bill, thank you for joining us. Thank you for the wealth of experience that you bring to these topics, as well as the great work you do with the show.
Frank, as always, and you've been in here. I think
nice to have you aboard.
I think you've been in here a dozen or half a dozen times, so we'll get you back. The problem is the world keeps coughing up extraordinarily bad stuff that we got to talk about, and this seems to be yet in the latest line of things to worry about, this bridge situation.
Well, you bring a background, I give you a hard time about it, in the financial arena, master of the universe, I call you, a retiring, recovering and retired one, albeit. But you have a sense, Bill, of economic matters more broadly as well. Talk about what has happened here with that as kind of our prism for the moment. We'll get into some of the other aspects of this disaster, but how do you calculate the impact on our economy and employment and so much more?
Well, let's do the easier part, in that this was the largest port on the East Coast. They recently dredged it so they could handle even bigger ships. I think the one that hit the bridge was, 1,000 feet long, which is enormous. But in terms of the commercial disruption, the supply chain experts, the logistical people, things like that, I think we'll pretty, in commercial terms anyway, adapt, reroute, come up, and the effect on the overall economy won't be that significant. It will be a big impact on the Baltimore economy. I think there was some 15,000 jobs tied to the port and the shipping business. Now they're going to reopen the port, but while they're repairing, while they're rebuilding the bridge, there's going to be massive disruption. But the key thing that why it's important and why I think we ought to be interested is this was opened in 1977, and it was specifically designed to provide alternate route for vehicles containing hazardous materials, including strategic military superior materials, nuclear, whatever, the whole list of and in fact this ship had some hazardous materials on it. So geostrategic importance is huge, and it makes a wonderful target if you're somebody who wants to put another dent in our infrastructure. You know, we're seeing attacks on infrastructures all over the world, as far away as the Red Sea, where the Houthis are lobbing drones at shipping, and we've also got problems in the Panama Canal. You know, presumably it's drought that's causing the Panama Canal to be closed to some ships, but who knows what the real reason is. And with this strategic importance, And the fact that this ship hit, it had two pylons it sat on, and that supported the whole bridge. And you've got a ship that of 1,000 feet, 1,500 foot span, hit exactly the spot that would bring the whole thing down. It's a highly suspicious, quote, accident. And the thing that's troubling is that we no longer trust our government to tell us the truth. Within minutes, within a couple hours, we had the head of the Baltimore FBI come out and assure us, there's no problem here, people, move along. There's no evidence that this is not a site, this is not a terrorist attack, it's nothing. And, well, how would he know? I mean, they hadn't looked at the black box.
Bill, I'm so glad you are able to confirm that, because I'd heard that that was the case. And, you know, we've seen the FBI do this on any number of previous occasions with, you know, jihadists, usually, who've engaged in some act of terror, and they're out there almost immediately saying, oh, there's nothing to see here, as you say, no terrorism. And it really raises the question, doesn't it, about not only why would they say that under circumstances like this, but what are they doing to prevent these sorts of things from happening? It does not, as you say, inspire confidence.
Well, we've talked about this with regard to our electrical grid. I mean, we've got an extremely vulnerable technological infrastructure, and this is, in this case, it's physical infrastructure, you know, good old-fashioned bridge. But nevertheless, the black box, the guidance systems in these ships are incredibly sophisticated, and you know, you don't really, it's more like a pilot flying a 747. The instruments are basically flying the plane. In this case, the instruments were basically driving the boat. Now, they had a couple of port pilots that are based in Baltimore on board. We haven't heard from them. We haven't heard from anybody who was on the ship. We haven't heard from who was the pilot on the ship. And so the idea you can proclaim there's no issue here. And then the internet, of course, is abuzz with rumors, and you can never really know which ones. But the latest rumor is that whistleblowers in China now claim that China has the technology to cut off power to ships. And, you know, the work we've done with space warfare with Brandon Weichert and other people that look at what the capabilities that China has from space, you can believe that something like that could be true. We just don't know. And we need to have, you know, and with everything we've learned about the FBI, we have reason to suspect that they're, you know, they're covering something up, or at least they want to cover something up until they know how to play it. And it's not good.
So we're being spun.
We're being spun.
Yeah. And Bill, if this weren't so serious, I mean, you could say, well, that's, you know, just incompetence or sort of trying to manage the information space. But it really smacks of malfeasance to me that they're trying to tell us, trust us. And the basis for that trust has, for reasons that you just sort of alluded to, been seriously dissipated, to say the
Frank,
least.
Frank, you and I believe, and a lot of other serious people, I'll put us among them, believe that we're at war. We're at war with China. And China has definite designs to be the preeminent power in the world. And while we may not think they're at war with us, they certainly are. And you know, we've got the spectacle now. We'll talk about this, I guess, in another block about the U.S. executives still making the trip to China. And
perfect segue, Bill. Hold the thought, because we got to take this very short break. Bill Walton is in the house. We're going to transition to this next hugely important question, which is, since we are at war with communist China, I call it World War Xi, why on earth are we still doing business with them, financing them, and depending upon them to sell us stuff? Bill Walton is in the house. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Biden administration reportedly wants to put American forces on the ground in Gaza. Clearly, there's a desperate need for adult supervision and urgent course corrections regarding Team Biden's policy towards Israel and the war upon which her very survival depends. Israeli media quote the seriously deficient Joint Chiefs Chairman, General C.Q. Brown, as saying Washington seeks a, quote, joint U.S.-Israeli command center in Rafah. Unquote. Best case, such an arrangement would embroil our military personnel in deadly fighting in that densely packed urban center. More likely and by design, it would create a furthered impediment to Israeli efforts to defeat Hamas decisively. The Israelis rightly do not want others fighting their wars, especially after last week's American betrayal of the UN and Team Biden's impending insidious Trojan horse port in Gaza. The job of defending the Jewish state must remain Israel's alone. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back. Bill Walton is in the house, our special guest about this time each week. We're always pleased to see him. Actually, it's usually earlier in the week. We've caught up with him late because of travel. But Bill, it's good to have you with us always. And we were just beginning a conversation about the possibility, and I don't want to suggest it's other than that at the moment, that the Chinese Communist Party might have had something to do with what happened here. And if not, that they almost certainly are positioned to do a lot of harm to us with the tens of thousands of what appear to be People's Liberation Army personnel they've insinuated into the country, thanks largely to Joe Biden's open border. But you just introduced another topic, which is what Americans who are what the Chinese call friends of China were doing in, I believe, Beijing this week. It's right out of the pages of a book to which you have contributed as one of our Committee on the Present Danger China members and great guests in our webinars. We call it The Indictment, Prosecuting the Chinese Communist Party and Friends for Crimes Against America, China, and the World is the title of the book, as you know. And it's all about what the people like those who were in China being feted by Xi Jinping this week are doing to help our enemy in this war against us. Talk a little bit about the meeting, who was there, and what should we take away?
Well, if maybe we reach back to our other segment for just one second, I want to make the point that both Chris Shea and Jen Easterly, Chris runs FBI and Jen runs the CISA, which is a part of Homeland Security. They now, in the last 3 or 4 months, have been arguing and declaiming that we have serious issues with the people coming across the border. We have cyber issues. We have infrastructure issues that we ought to be recognizing. We need to be in a war footing. And these are the people responsible for our security. I'm glad to see they're saying this, even though I have issues with them in other areas. Now, talk about what's though happened right now this week in Beijing, and we have 20 or more, maybe 50 U.S. CEOs who've gone to a meeting with President Xi of China. And while on the one hand, Xi is shutting down China's attractiveness for investment with their security regime and they're blocking the access to the capital markets, et cetera, et cetera. U.S. CEOs are going there and he's trying to to convince them that no, China's really a great place to do business. And who do we see there? Steve Schwarzman, Blackstone, the head of FedEx, the head of Qualcomm, head of insurer Chubb. We also have Graham Allison, who was the founding dean of Harvard School of Government. So they're there, they're sitting there, and the visuals are interesting. They're all sitting like students around a big circular table, and they're all assiduously taking notes while President Xi is assuring them that that they should be friends to China. They ought to be, well, I don't know what I would think. As a shareholder, I'd be very concerned that these people are deploying your money, continuing to deploy your shareholder money into China. And, you know, my view is that when things really get tough with China, that those investments they make in China will be worth zero.
Yeah.
And Xi will say, thank you for the investment, but you no longer own it.
It may be your shareholder money, or it may be just your life savings that you've invested with people on Wall Street who, well, Bill, decided to deploy it there. And Bill, again,
just to follow up on this point, who's responsible for this in the government? I'd say the spokesman for this particular issue, well, it might be the Secretary of Commerce, but it really ought to be the Secretary of Treasury. And instead of Janet Yellen telling people, let's be careful about this, she's going back over to Beijing to talk about climate and to talk about, green energy supplies and that sort of thing. And she's over there negotiating price on green energy, while at the same time, China's eating her lunch strategically.
Well, and maybe doing so in a more physical way before too long. Yeah. Bill, let me just ask you about this, because I think, we had the spectacle, and I'm sure there's some overlap between the people who were around that table with Xi in Beijing and the people who were applauding him and standing ovation after standing ovation in San Francisco a few months ago.
Some of the same people.
Certainly the Venn diagram, there's an overlap there. But, you know, what we argue in the book, the indictment, Bill, as you know, is we need to make examples of these people. And we talk about the indictment and in prosecutorial terms, we make the case that, you know, there is, in fact, I believe, reason to consider what they're doing is kind of racketeering with a transnational criminal enterprise. But whether you ever got to court or not, in the court of public opinion, naming and shaming these people seems to me to be the bare minimum of what we could do. We talked about getting on a war footing in the previous segment. Boy, that's as needed in this space as anything else, because we're in this position. And again, you spent time on Wall Street. You know it better than just about anybody. We're in a position where we are underwriting the greatest threat to our country we've ever faced. And it's continuing. And the thing I prize about our conversations, Bill, is you really do understand, you know, the economic condition over there. This is a mug's game. You know, they have to know things are going seriously sideways at best, if not in a corkscrew into the ground.
These men, and they're almost all men, have massive egos, and they've been courted by the Chinese Communist Party. They've been led to believe they're special individuals, that they're going to be treated differently, and they're brought in, and they're wined and dined, and that really appeals to their ego. Now, what's also going to be appealing to them is the promise of great riches in China. And I don't understand their thinking, because the returns in the Chinese stock market, for example, have been close to zero over the last 10, 20 years. And so we're not making money in that market. But the thing they will respond to, Frank, is fear of the U.S. government not sanctioning what they're doing. And they will respond to political direction if we give it to them. And Trump was beginning to do that. But with Biden and Yellen and the rest of the crew, it's just the opposite. I mean, they've publicly declared that climate change is the biggest security risk we face as a country, not China. And the second thing,
and as a result, we need to partner with China. Inclusion. Right?
And so they're going over to China, not negotiating with a potential kinetic enemy, but somebody who they want to do deals with on climate. And it just the disconnect between reality and what they're doing is just stunning.
Well, Bill, we talk with you and others on this program a lot about what's motivating that, and there is a deep suspicion. Our friend Sam Faddis has put a very fine point on it by describing Joe Biden as a, quote, controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party, unquote. And others have pointed out, Trevor Loudon among them recently, that, what would he be doing differently if he actually was working overtly for the enemy? And I can't think of a thing.
No.
But so just to come back to these guys, because, you made the point that the investor, the so-called shareholder, may not have profited from all of this. But is it fair to say that most of these guys with the big egos have personally profited and perhaps quite handsomely from engaging with China, becoming one of its old friends?
Well, so far, yes, absolutely. And let's also report on something else that's happening. Tim Cook, who runs Apple, just was over in China in one of the provincial state capitals, and with a new Apple store. They're opening new Apple stores. Starbucks is just this 2 weeks ago was announcing they want to get.
We're out of time. I've got to leave it at that. So we'll come back to you for more.
This is the problem we've got to address right now.
Amen. God bless you, sir. Come back to us again soon. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and what a delight to be able to welcome once again Christine Douglas Williams, one of our wonderful friends from north of the border. We talk a lot about what's going on south of the border, but she is keeping her eye, fortunately for all of us, on the northern border from her perch in Toronto in Canada. She's also keeping an eye on a lot of other things, which she writes about with regularity as an editor for both Front Page magazine and for jihadwatch.org. Christine is the author of several important books, including The Challenge of Modernizing Islam, which is very much with us at the moment, in particular, as it manifests itself in the death struggle that Israel currently finds itself with, Hamas and other Sharia supremacists. We're going to talk a little bit about what's happening there and what both the Canadian government and that of the United States are doing to undermine our friends and allies in Israel. Christine, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
It's always a pleasure to join you, Frank.
Thank you. Let me start by asking you to just sort of level set with us. Of course, there was a UN Security Council resolution earlier in the week. I don't believe Canada is on the Security Council at this time. I'm not sure about that, but we are. Of course, we're permanent members. And the Biden administration chose for the first time not to veto one of the resolutions out of the council that was insisting that there must be an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and much renewed and expanded humanitarian relief there. What's your perspective on the fact that the Biden team abstained rather than veto that? And what's it look like from Canada as well?
This was an article I addressed, actually, Frank, and I'm glad you're asking me about it, for both Jihad Watch and Front Page magazine about that UN Security Council vote. The crisis in Israel, and what a lot of people aren't getting, the emphasis coming from the media is the humanitarian crisis, which we know exists. However, people are not considering the fight that Israel faces for its very existence. They're also not considering, when you look at the worst war in history, it was World War II, and nations stood up for themselves. So they're demanding that Israel not stand up for itself and risk obliteration. And before that, more attacks, even worse than October 7th. What a lot of people do not realize is that Egypt is an option for the refugees to escape to, if everybody really does care about Palestinian lives. But they have actually chosen not to open their borders. And even worse, they're accepting bribes, Frank, at the border. So those desperate Palestinians that want to escape, that have the money, paying thousands of dollars, they're paying it in bribes to get in as refugees. So it is a crime what's going on with Egypt. It's horrible what's going on with the Hamas human shields, but nobody's calling them out. They're focusing on the humanitarian disaster and blaming Israel for the whole thing. And they're not putting the blame where it's due, which is on Hamas and even on Egypt for not even helping out with the refugees at their border, but yet accepting the bribes.
Well, I can understand why the Egyptians are very concerned about letting Palestinians who, you know, are governed by and sympathetic to the Muslim Brotherhood's franchise, Brotherhood having essentially brought down one Egyptian government and misruled horribly when it took power. Hamas is the Brotherhood's franchise, as you know, Christine, in Gaza. And I think that the question that just keeps eluding us is all of this could stop immediately, Frank, if Hamas would simply surrender.
But there's no emphasis.
Nobody is doing a thing about at this moment.
Exactly. And we don't hear them talking in the media a lot about what you just mentioned, about the Muslim Brotherhood, the threat that Hamas would pose to Egypt. The entire focus is on Israel, calling Israel an abuser, even accusing Israel of genocide, which is just obscene when you consider the threat facing the state of Israel. And
well, talk about that for a moment. You said that this is an existential threat. You know, Christine, I've thought about this over the years and come to the conclusion that one of the most brilliant acts of political warfare, kind of jujitsu, was the transformation of Israel's David to the Arab's Goliath, in which case people were very sympathetic to Israel and understood, you know, is fighting for its life, to the current situation, which is Israel as the Goliath to the poor Palestinians' David. And the sympathies are clearly with the, you know, far less powerful but jihadist and dangerous enemy that Israel and we face. Let's face it, you understand this better than anybody. Your book about modernizing Islam is...
I'm listening to you, Frank. And that is exactly what Dr. Tawfiq Hamid with the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies indicated in my book, that it is a sore point for Islamic supremacists that this tiny state of Israel could be doing this, could have that kind of power. And there is no success in obliterating that country. It is a very sore spot for Islamic supremacists who feel that they should have the power and religious power, let alone the size of these states, yet they are failing to obliterate the state of Israel. This is a point that he addressed eloquently in the challenge of modernizing Islam.
That was before the present circumstance, which, as you said, and now, I think you're exactly right. You know, Israel's existence is on the line. And Christine, talk, because you've got a deep understanding of all this, talk about what the stakes for us were. Israel, in fact, to be defeated by probably not just Hamas alone, but some combination of all of these Iranian proxies and Iran itself, for that matter.
Frank, I don't think, okay, let me put it this way. There are many, and I read these stories again and again about the America First, and it's great to put America first. By doing that, when you support Israel on the front lines of this jihad battle, you're actually helping America. Israel is facing obliteration by the Muslim Brotherhood linked Hamas. Hamas has indicated clearly, in line with the Muslim Brotherhood, that they have in mind a global caliphate. Frank, you've been talking about this for years, if not over a decade. And
hold the thought, Christine. We have to come back. I don't want to interrupt where you're going with this, but we do need to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Christine Douglas Williams. Oh, I beg your pardon. I was going to carry on. I was going to go for 11 minutes and 40 seconds in this block. Just carry on.
Okay. So when one says that we're not looking after American interests by putting money into Israel, they're not understanding the front line battle that Israel is waging. This is a global issue. It is not only Israel's problem. Israel is known by Iran and frequently referred to as the little Satan, while America is referred to as the great Satan. They're coming after America too. So Israel being on the front lines of this needs to be supported, not just because it's the right thing to do. When you look at globally, the amount of money America has been giving internationally, even to UNRWA, it is obscene. But to help Israel is to help America with the battle of jihad that is being highly underplayed in America by authorities in the Democrat camp.
Well, you guys do a fabulous job, Robert Spencer, and you as one of his daily contributors and editors, at laying all this out. And I can't thank you enough for doing so. As you indicated, we go back a ways on these mutual concerns. But I think what jihadwatch.org does day in and day out to not only bring news of what the green part of the red-green axis, as well as the red part, the communist part, the Marxist part, are up to is indispensable. So thank you for all of that. Let me just ask you about one other piece of this that just brings into sharp relief the magnitude of the betrayal that the Biden team has engaged in. There's this port that Joe Biden announced at his State of the Union address. He was going to tell the Army to go build a temporary port, but it'll likely be permanent, to allow Hamas to get, you know, relief assistance, food, yes, but also God knows what all else, fuel, reconstruction materials, and probably arms, brought in without having to go through Israeli screening and checkpoints. One of the things that's particularly alarming to me about all this, Christine, as you may know, is that the woman who has been, I think, a prime mover behind this idea of getting the United States to put forces in, NATO forces, our forces, to protect the Palestinians, named, what's her name? Samantha Power, is now making arrangements for the management of this port. And she's engaged the Qataris and a company in Qatar that is owned by Hamas called Al Hizri. What's wrong with that picture?
Well, the biggest thing, first of all, is that the betrayal is one thing. Now we're looking at outright interference by the American government. And in addition to that, of all nations, Qatar, I mean, you're looking at a country that is a powerful Muslim Brotherhood supporter. I mean, when you look at the implications of what we're discussing here, Frank, it almost looks as if there's a sabotage involved here against the state of Israel. It is criminal what we see happening, but the interference is particularly worrying because what role does that create for Israel in this battle? How will they fight? Are they going to fight America in order to protect its own nation? America is placing itself in
That's exactly the idea. It's not just that it looks that way, Christine.
It is that way.
That's the plan.
Exactly. That's right.
Thank you for joining us today. I hope you'll come back to us soon. We've got to talk more about Canada in the near future. There's
lots going on there,
as you know. God bless you, my dear.
God bless you,
Have
Frank.
A good Easter. Say
you too.
Folks, we'll be right back.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Biden administration reportedly wants to put American forces on the ground in Gaza. Clearly, there's a desperate need for adult supervision and urgent course corrections regarding Team Biden's policy towards Israel and the war upon which her very survival depends. Israeli media quote the seriously deficient Joint Chiefs Chairman, General C.Q. Brown, as saying Washington seeks a, quote, joint U.S.-Israeli command center in Rafah. Unquote. Best case, such an arrangement would embroil our military personnel in deadly fighting in that densely packed urban center. More likely and by design, it would create a furthered impediment to Israeli efforts to defeat Hamas decisively. The Israelis rightly do not want others fighting their wars, especially after last week's American betrayal of the UN and Team Biden's impending insidious Trojan horse port in Gaza. The job of defending the Jewish state must remain Israel's alone. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say, always, that Robert Charles is in the house. Bobby is one of those men who has served his country in a variety of capacities. In fact, not only in uniform in the Naval Intelligence of the United States Navy, but also in all three branches of our government. The executive branch, as most recently an assistant secretary of state, in the judicial branch as a clerk in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and on Capitol Hill as a senior investigator in congressional committees charged with oversight and investigations. Bobby Charles, it's great to have you with us, sir. Thank you for joining us always.
Frank, always glad to be here.
I wanted to start by, first of all, thanking you and Rebecca Weber and Barb Karlstrom at the Association of Mature American Citizens for being such wonderful partners in our sovereignty coalition and using the vehicle that AMAC.us represents, the flagship of an organization I'm proud to be a member of, by the way, to keep your members apprised of what is going on that bears directly on, well, not only the national interest, but theirs individually as well. And as you know, one of the things that we've been partnering on with our sovereignty coalition is this World Health Organization, well, they call it Global Governance Initiative, not one, but two, well, what amount to treaties that are about to be approved at the end of May, all of the things being equal, and that have really profound implications for the Constitution of the United States, which is not about global governance. It is about limited checks and balances, representative government under our Constitution. Give us an overview of why AMAC is concerned about all this, as should all of us be.
So let me give you three simple points, I guess, Frank, on this. First, AMAC, millions of members nationwide, an incredible engine for conservative thinking, is also an engine for sovereignty. Now, what does that mean? It means that we believe in the sovereignty of your own mind and your own heart and your own faith. It means we believe in sovereignty in our border. It also means that we believe in the concept of sovereignty as it's understood, or was understood by our founders, which means that there are borders that are physical, but there are also borders that have to do with law and the rights of people to govern themselves. And at no time did any of our founders contemplate, in fact, George Washington's departure speech, farewell speech, was profound in this regard. At no time did they ever suggest, want, or imply that we should be entangled in foreign enterprises, never mind give away our sovereignty to foreign entities. So it's as anti-American as apple pie is American. The second thing I'll say is that sovereignty is an issue that people don't think a lot about. They tend to think, well, look, I can get to the grocery store and I haven't been thrown in prison and I've got my basics together here. Well, the reality is that you can lose the most important things in your life: your freedom of speech, your freedom to defend yourself with a firearm, your ability to, I mean, all you got to do is go back to the book 1984 and see very clearly where this could go and is going. So sovereignty is a very real, tangible thing. It doesn't seem palpable, but it is. And the last thing I'll say is that, you know, we think in terms, sometimes people say, well, you know, that's just a treaty and we could just walk away from it. And after all, those things are supposed to be, yes, they are, put before our United States Senate for ratification. That's all true. But then you get a president like an Obama or a president like a Biden, and they begin to force mandates down your throat that are not based any longer even on their own pride and prejudice, but now are based on the concept that the world will dictate to us whether or not we have gas stoves, whether or not we get to drive cars. Bottom line is, Frank, when you give away a little, you lose a lot. And we are starting, these treaties are absolutely rock. They are, if you give away, you know, Plymouth Rock, the story changes. And so we can't not give that away.
Yeah, that's well said, Bobby. Let me just hone in on two things that you touched on there that I think, in addition, I believe, to the affront that an arrangement that would have an unaccountable, unelected foreign bureaucrat like Tedros Ghebreyesus being the arbiter of our personal medical health.
Yeah.
By virtue of saying what your doctor can prescribe or even discuss with you.
Yeah.
That's bad enough. But on top of it, there are these things like the idea that that individual will be able to determine that a subject like gun violence is a public health emergency of international concern,
yeah,
and order us to eliminate guns, obviously starting with the legal ones registered by law-abiding American patriots, that could all be scarfed up with the, obviously, the help of the U.S. government, which would be only too happy to do that.
No? Yeah, you know, Frank, I want to take off on that for a moment. I recently, just for my own edification, reread the progression that occurred between roughly 1904 through 1922 when the Bolsheviks took over the Russian people and their government. And what shocked me, particularly about the period 1917, was how fast things happened. These Russian people, actually, believe it or not, most of them were perhaps like 95% were against this revolution. They didn't want to have all their rights taken away. But what happened was a few people got themselves in a position of authority and declared it as a fait accompli. They said it has happened. And by the time the rest of that country got itself together to respond, it was literally too late. And we had 70 years of the Soviet Union to prove it. So the problem with this, Frank, is we have seen the beta run. We saw the test flight of all this during COVID, when China, which also controls lots of the health, the global health infrastructure, and of course wants a communist global government, China clearly put in our face a number of decisions. Do you or don't you abide by what we, the world, thinks? We're not going to tell you where the virus came from. We're not even going to let you in here, but we're going to make you do what we want. And then will your governors and will your president fold over and take your rights away? And you know what? The test flight...
We saw how it worked.
Well, the test flight worked great for them and it crashed for us. So at the end of the day, we're in a tough moment.
We are, and we need everybody's help, including AMAC.us, of course, in opposing these two treaties. And you can find out more about how to do that at sovereigntycoalition.org. Be right back with more with Robert Charles. Stay tuned. We're back. Robert Charles is in the house. I'm very pleased to say we're going to continue briefly our conversation about the World Health Organization Global Governance Gambit, as they call it. We're going to turn, Bobby, from your Second Amendment rights being imperiled by this arrangement of entrusting what makes for a public health emergency of international concern to a Marxist by the name of Tedros Ghebreyesus, the Director General of the WHO, to another element. And we've heard the Supreme Court considering what the Biden administration has already been doing to censor freedom of speech guaranteed in the First Amendment to our Constitution. That would be institutionalized now under the World Health Organization regimen. It will be obligatory on our country to have censorship mechanisms to prevent people from saying things that deviate from the party line of the WHO.
Well, you're right. I mean, the only thing worse, Frank, than one party government in this country would be one party government for the world. Of course, they would be synonymous here. They would be the same thing for us. But you're absolutely right. The right to free speech, go back and look at the First and Second Amendments. They are not equivocal. They are not, you used the word guarantee. That's what they are. They are guarantees. And what these regimes aim to do is think about how much you hate any individual hates the idea. Maine just rejected, for example, electric vehicles mandates of 82% by 2027 or 32. We rejected these things because we live in a place where we have the power to reject those things, okay? And we don't get called crazy. If we say we might be called crazy, and maybe that's part of the First Amendment, but we're given the opportunity to say that we don't agree with this. We don't agree with CRT. We don't agree with this DEI. We don't agree with the idea of Marxism in our schools. We don't agree with the idea that parents are terrorists. We don't agree with the idea that the border should be wide open. Those are all things that freedom of speech allow. That speech is the means by which we correct ourselves and put ourselves back on track again. If you take that away, you not only take away the ability to correct yourself, but you put yourself on a track into a rock wall, and that's not what we want as a country.
Bobby, both of these and so many other aspects of this World Health Organization endeavor reflect what we learned from the China, yeah, Wuhan virus pandemic. Was the China model of restrictions and lockdowns, yeah, and jabs and mask, yeah, mandates and so on. In China today, we have the spectacle of American friends of China, I guess one might call them. Mm-hmm. That's what the Chinese call them. People who have been determined to do business with the Chinese have profited generally personally, if not corporately, handsomely from doing so. Bobby, talk a little bit about the fact that these are people who are, as a practical matter, helping in one way or another, whether it's through legitimization or whether it's through financing or whether it's business endeavors and transfer of technology and so on. They're helping to prop up the government that is our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party. I don't know that there's a precedent for this, certainly not on this scale, but talk a little bit about what we're facing in this regard.
So I think Americans need to remember, and this is true of the press, and it is also true of our business community, that when you think you're making profit at the expense of someone with no harm, but you're promoting things that undermine the legitimacy of your own country and the future of your own country, then you're really working against the interests of your country, and that means against the interests of yourself and your kids and everybody else. You cannot outrun an attempt to take away your freedom by having more money. Eventually, they come for your money too. And the precedent, quite frankly, Frank, the precedent is Germany, okay, World War II. Not only did they come for people's money, they came for their lives. And before that, what was happening? And this is something, I mean, Charles Lindbergh is kind of the example of this. What was happening? What was happening was that American businesses, like the British were also doing business in Japan, American businesses were doing business with Germany. And they did business with Germany right up until the moment when it became a kinetic war. We say kinetic now. Let's just say gross, physical, violent, horrible war. Because they wanted to put their heads in the sand and believe it wasn't going to happen. And the problem is, Frank, all indicators here are we're heading in a direction of increasing kinetic, cyber, all kinds of conflict with China. Surveillance, information warfare. And you got to be smart. You can't be stupid. And these guys are going over there, I think, and they're just basically soaking up the Chinese money the same way that there were businessmen who soaked up German money until the last minute.
Personally, benefiting and profiting.
Yeah, personally.
This is so worrying on so many different levels, but I mean, I appreciate your clarity on the point. You know, we've written in our book, The Indictment, about, let me grab it. We've written in our book, The Indictment, about prosecuting the Chinese Communist Party and friends for crimes against America, China, and the world. And this seems to me, whether it's in the legal court or the court of public opinion, these people need to be named and shamed for what amounts to betrayal of our country.
You know, the difficulty is, Frank, in the public mind, and I think it is a public court. Of court of public opinion. In the public mind, there are the precedents of the Cold War at its most extreme, the Cuban Missile Crisis, extraordinary espionage, etc. And then there was the period of rapprochement or détente, which was ushered in by Henry Kissinger. The thing you have to understand is that history is dynamic, okay? But you have to understand where you are on that dynamic effort. And would it be nice to have China increasingly move toward freedom of liberties for their people? Of course it would. Would rapprochement in that environment be good? Yes. But we're not in that environment. We're in an environment where their Communist Party plenaries are saying they essentially want to take over the world. They want to do it through 5G. They want to do it through surveillance. They want to do it through the international organizations. So you have to understand where you are on. Yeah, and kinetically, they're laying in ICBMs. You have to see where you are on the arc of history. And where we are is in a place where we must be aware that we are under fire.
Yeah, and resisting this self-interest on the part of individuals to profit by enabling our enemy. We have to leave it at that. Robert Charles, thank you for your time today and your great service to our country, which continues these days as a spokesman for the Association of Mature American Citizens. Come back to us again soon, if you would, sir. God bless. Hope the rest of you do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.